Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. So I'm excited. We have some games this weekend. A thousand names is on deck. There are quite a few intriguing matches. So we'll hear his take on what to expect during the Serie A weekend. We have a fantastic guest today. We have Napoli Outsider. We recorded a very long special for our patrons, which we do once a month. I included in today's pod, him and I talked for about 40 minutes about the state of Italian football, why the team isn't going to the World Cup for the second time in a row. So I think you'll really enjoy that. There was a lot that happened in pop culture. We had the Will Smith Oscar slap. Curious to hear Alex's take on that. So we'll do that at the end, and then we'll pay tribute to Taylor Hawkins to wrap up the pod. But before we get to all that, I'm joined by our dear friend, Alex Goldberg. It's been slow news days in Chelsea recently, so he must be excited to get on to talk about football. So Alex, today, I want to ask you in a second about the Mendy Donnarumma thing, because I find it really fascinating. I have one thought on it, but I'm very curious to hear you. But, you know, this weekend we have some huge Serie A games with huge Scudetto implications. The big one, of course, is on Sunday night, Juve hosting Inter. So I'm going to ask you this, Alex, more than a prediction on this game, I am interested in your thoughts on what you think would be the best result for Milan in this game.
Yeah, interesting. So I feel like the worst result would be Inter winning. I really do feel like that, because Inter do have a game in hand on Milan. So if they were to win, then they'd be even on games and only 3 points behind. They have the better goal differential. And David, for a while, we thought this was Inter's title, right? Like for a while, for most of this season, I'm not saying most of the season, but there was a good chunk of the season where it felt like, all right, this is Inter's title to lose, you could say. And if Inter can get a big win against Juve with still enough games to definitely mathematically take this over from Milan if they slip up once or twice, then I don't think Milan wants Inter feeling this momentum of a win at the weekend, because I think that could propel them to maybe make their push. You know, I think about, I'm not big into F1. I know it's a huge sport these days, F1, but more the big sport in America for a long time, NASCAR, where, all right, there's a driver who is not in the lead, but for that final lap, he is just going to rev it up a little bit more and pass the rest. And I think a win against Juve from an Inter perspective could really kind of give them that push to maybe get this title, because they're not that far off. I know you look at the standings and they're 6 points down, but like I said, they got a game in hand, so they only be 3 points down with that goal differential advantage. Juve winning is not ideal, but they're even on games, Milan and Juve, and I still don't think Milan will slip up that much. Juve would get to 62 points if they beat Inter. So I definitely do think the best result, well, I mean, you know, it's not a bad question, because one could argue, well, don't allow Inter to get any points. You know, I do want to say draw. I do think that is the best result for Milan, but I guess it isn't that easy, in fairness to your question, because would we rather hear Inter get 0 points from a Milan perspective, give Juve those three? Yep, they're tied on games and they're 4 points down, which could be a little too close for Milan's liking, because Juve are still Juve and they have a really talented team. You know, in speaking out loud, I'm almost wondering if we should just not allow Inter to get any points from a Milan perspective. It'd be 5 points down. Here, listeners can listen to me work this out in live time. They'd be 5 points down. They'd be even on games. I don't know. I'm going to still go with a draw. I'm still going to go with a draw. Yeah. But definitely the second best result is Juve getting the win and Inter getting zero. Because, listen, I think to not answer the way you asked it, but to really hammer home what I'm most emphatic about within this answer, is Inter getting 3 points should definitely scare Milan, David. That's for sure. So a draw, or maybe Milan fans will disagree and say actually Juve winning is the most ideal scenario. As you can tell, I'm kind of torn between a draw or a Juve win. So, David, that's where I'm at. What about you?
Yeah, look, originally I thought the best result for Milan was definitely a Juve win, but then I think it through and maybe draw or not. So I'll go through kind of a similar process than you. So let's start with Juve. We've said it a few times. Even if Juve runs the table and wins every game the rest of the way, they can get the 83 points, which might be enough this year to win the Scudetto. It normally wouldn't be. So they need to run the whole table. So let's say Juve beats Inter on Sunday. That's the only result they can have to still be alive in the Scudetto race, in my opinion. Even a draw, then at that point, that their ceiling's 81 points. You're not going to win the Scudetto with that, with so many teams there. So to me, Juve has to win to have any chance to still be in the Scudetto race. And I would argue, even if they do, it's rough. So based on that, I think absolutely the worst thing for Milan would be an Inter win, because I also think morale-wise, this would be exactly what Inter needs. They have been in a slump. There's been a lot of criticism. Now they know when the game against Bologna is going to take place. There was a lot, but it's not going to be anytime soon. It's in 3 weeks, so at least they know that that's set. To me, this could really be a big turnaround for Inter. I'm going to go down with the ship. I did predict Inter. I'm not going to write them off for the Scudetto at all. I do think if they win this game, they can do it. There are still a little bit of questions on Pioli's team holding out until the end, but I think long and short of it, for Juve, any result that's not a win totally takes them out of the Scudetto race. So draw, yeah. Inter, if they get a draw, it would be very hard for them to come up. It wouldn't totally take them out. So I'm going to go the worst result for Milan is Inter, and also because the morale thing is really good. But I also am going to tie this into Donnarumma. I know there's, I through you, I love getting a peek at the Chelsea Twitter, and I've noticed there's been a lot of debate on Mendy Donnarumma. You've kind of talked a little bit about it on the pod, and I kind of find it ironic that we're talking about it now on what can really be a huge weekend for Milan's Scudetto chances. Because in addition to Inter traveling to face Juve in Turin, we also have Napoli going to play Atalanta, and a pretty decimated Napoli now. On our patron chat, Napoli Outsider went on all the bad luck that Napoli's facing, and they really do have a lot of injuries going into this game against Atalanta. So there's a chance that by the time Milan play on Monday, they could make a big, big leap to become. To be really in the driver's seat for the Scudetto, which brings me back to Donnarumma, who famously said the reason why he was leaving Milan is he wanted to go to a place, to a club that had bigger ambitions, which I have to say, in retrospect, so far, it's looking as bad as the quote of Cerci's girlfriend back in the day when he left Torino to go to Atletico Madrid. And she's like, "We're finally going to the football that matters. We're leaving all this behind." He was a massive bust, came back to Serie A, played in the lower divisions. Now, I don't think Donnarumma is going to come back and be in the lower divisions, but certainly things have not gone as planned. So, Alex, take a victory lap. I think right now the Mendy Donnarumma debate is pretty one-sided. What would be the case for Mendy being a superior keeper to Donnarumma right now?
Wow. There'd just be so many things, honestly. First of all, Donnarumma is not the best keeper right now in Ligue 1. Mendy is the best keeper. And sure, there are really good keepers in the Premier League, but just on a tiebreaker, is the best keeper in the Premier League. And normally I don't like to get into the whole, well, this league's the best, that league is the worst, etc., etc. But I'm sorry. Premier League over Ligue 1 every damn day of the week. So, like I said, Donnarumma is a worse keeper in a worse league than Edouard Mendy. Also, Mendy has simply won more trophies lately than Donnarumma. Yes, Donnarumma won the Euros. Big congratulations to him. But Mendy is winning just about everything possible. Even just a day ago, David, or 2 days ago, Mendy, another save in a penalty shootout, the thing that he's not even supposed to be good at, okay, even though he also had one in the AFCON final not that long ago to win another trophy, a huge trophy. The other day, Mendy, another save in pens, and what does this one do? Oh, it brings his team, Senegal, to the World Cup. Where's Donnarumma going to be during the World Cup? Where's he going to be? Sorry, David. Where's he going to be? He's going to be at home. He's going to be at home. And could he take some blame in that? Oh, he could. Oh, he definitely could. Great shot by the North Macedonia player. But you ask any goalkeeper, could Donnarumma be standing in a better spot using better angles? 1,000%. How many times have I heard recently Donnarumma could use better angles? Karim Benzema is still laughing at the gift Donnarumma gave him in that Champions League tie the other week. I mean, if Donnarumma doesn't pretty much give the ball to Benzema, maybe Benzema never even makes that comeback. I love the guy, so if anybody's going to be biased towards Benzema, it'd be me. But Donnarumma decided, you know what? I think we need to allow Real Madrid back in this. Let's see what they can do. He literally started that. One of the most ridiculous comebacks in Champions League history. Good keeper. Good keeper. Can be great. But I don't know. David, he kind of fills me with like a James Harden vibe. Okay? Meaning really good player. But I guarantee you, David, James Harden's never, and I understand Donnarumma won the Euros, okay? I do understand that. James Harden is never winning an NBA championship as the guy. He's never winning one. Missing something. Okay? Edouard Mendy, he's got it all. He's got it absolutely all. I mean, first of all, like the save percentages, you want to get into nerdy goalkeeper stats? I was about to do that here, but I decided that doesn't really play as well over a microphone. But you actually want to go to the nerds, if you will, and ask who's better? Don't worry. Mendy will be demolishing Donnarumma in that. But Mendy just fulfills me, but I think just even the objective viewer, with a lot more confidence. I have Asmir Begovic on my podcast, current goalkeeper for Everton. Really nice guy, objective guy. David, former Milan player, right? Also, David, you want some objectivity? He was a teammate of Donnarumma's. He was backup to Donnarumma for half a season. And if there's anyone who's going to be nice and friendly and objective, it's Asmir Begovic. Absolutely. And he definitely likes GG, and he thinks really highly of him, but he absolutely said without hesitation, Edouard Mendy is the best goalkeeper in the world right now. And Donnarumma, when he was listing the keepers, wasn't even second out of his mouth. So that should probably tell you, right? A Milan player himself who literally was, you know, goalkeepers, David. I don't need to tell you because you actually have a goalkeeping background as well, but goalkeepers are sometimes even in their own worlds, you know, during training where, sure, every once in a while they'll join in with the rest of the team, but they really are doing their own training and their own goalkeeping group for a long period of time. So remember, Begovic was with Donnarumma for a lot of time. And yeah, without hesitation, Mendy. Even though Mendy's tall, like Donnarumma, David, better with his feet right now. There's no doubt about it. And he doesn't make these silly mistakes. Sometimes you kind of wonder with Donnarumma. See, I think a better version of Donnarumma right now, and David, you're going to be floored when I say this, is Courtois. I think Courtois is a better goalkeeper than Donnarumma right now. I do. I think Donnarumma is still top five, but Courtois is not even making those mistakes right now. So, yeah, I think Donnarumma also loses a little bit of a clutch gene at times, which is really important as a goalkeeper. Yeah, James Harden is my comparison, David. That might be good to some, but if you pay attention to the NBA, I think you know that means good on the surface, really some red flags in other areas. Yeah, so he'll have his high FIFA rating all you like, kids, all you like. But just remember where he'll be next November, December, whatever, and where Mendy will be. Italy versus Senegal. Senegal's going, Italy's not. Anyway, David, what's your retort?
Wow. Wow. Well, I'll tell you, this is one time no one's going to complain about little Chelsea talk on the pod, because right now Donnarumma has no defenders. I've used this analogy before. This is like in The Wire when Avon tells Stringer, you're a man without a country right now. You're no longer a street dealer. You're trying to be this businessman and you've lost both sides of it. Donnarumma's in this boat. There's really not that many people that are going to come to Donnarumma's defense. I would say
Can
maybe
I actually
the people that
quickly, I'm so sorry, David, before you get knee deep into what you're about to say, I have one more thing to say. Donnarumma statistically is not even the best goalkeeper on his team. Like factually, Keylor Navas has literally outperformed him in goals allowed per 90, save percentage, those things like that. And by the way, Donnarumma doesn't even play more than Keylor Navas. So it's like, how is this discussion even to be had? I get why you're asking me it, But how can someone even say with a straight face that Donnarumma is a better goalkeeper right now? He's not even the best keeper on his own team.
Yeah, well, listen, this is another thing why he's a man without a country right now. Look, I think what's impressive about Mendy is, correct me when I'm wrong, when he came on board, it wasn't totally said that he was going to be the starter at Chelsea. And a lot of what you hear about Donnarumma is like, well, you know, this is why it's so important for the keeper to be the clear number one, which I totally agree. I think this is part of the reason why Donnarumma is, you know, struggling so much, as he doesn't know when he's going to play and all. But yeah, he's a man without a country who's coming to his defense as probably Juve fans. And when you were saying, where's Donnarumma going to be during the World Cup? You never know. He might be in Florida when Serie A does the tour instead of being at the World Cup, maybe with Juve. I don't think it's going to happen this summer. I think Juve is going to get at least one more year out of Szczesny, who has been playing really well after his struggles through. So yeah, Donnarumma right now is definitely a man without a country. Look, I would, if I was a club, I would absolutely gamble on Donnarumma bouncing back. I do agree, the goal against Macedonia, like, look, he was even robbed of a chance to go to penalty kicks and save Italy once again by giving up that goal, because that's where you feel the safest. And I know there's even that tweet of the penalty that where he kind of had a little bit of a blunder, but I would always take my chances. You're telling me my team's going to a penalty shootout, I have Donnarumma in goal, I feel really good about that. He was even deprived of that. And it goes back to, you know, what we've been talking a lot on the podcast, greed. We've talked about it with Lukaku. Sure, growth is great. Sometimes you should definitely see growth in life. But there's also sometimes, if you're in a great situation, Donnarumma was a young keeper. Milan was finally back in the Champions League. He didn't know the draw, but he could have been Milan's captain at Anfield this season. Right now, Milan control their destiny. When it comes to the Scudetto, Milan control their destiny on April 1st, and Donnarumma struggling like that. So yeah, I agree. That was a great rant, Alex. I think this is a time, even people are like, Chelsea talk. So many people right now are down on Donnarumma. I'm sure a lot of Milan fans enjoyed that. Before we get 2,000 names predictions, I want to ask you this on Rudiger, because there's been a couple of weeks ago, there was the reports that he was going to Juve. And look, it came from the same people that were first on Vlahovic. So I think a lot of people took that seriously. I'm not disparaging their work. I'm sure they had good information at the time. But now we saw that Rudiger did meet with Barcelona. So I think it's safe to say he does not have a deal with Juve. I saw Fabrizio, and I'm sure Chelsea are going to want to retain him, but, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty with the ownership. So let's just take Chelsea out of the equation for one second. If you had to just look at Juve and Barcelona as the next team for Rudiger without Chelsea being in the mix, which one do you think has a better chance?
Yeah, it's a good question. The Barca thing the other day when it popped up, admittedly, it did surprise me. Like, normally I am kind of privately keeping up to date on where players could go, transfer stuff, but I don't need to inform people that I've probably been asking about different things these days when I ask my Chelsea guys, and the takeover has really just been clouding us even speaking about players. So it did kind of catch me by surprise a little bit, seeing the Rudiger and Barcelona thing. But then I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking, makes sense. Not because Christensen's going there. I'm not saying Rudiger and Christensen are like best mates and Rudiger has to follow Christensen there. I mean, they're not enemies either, but I just don't think that holds that much water. I think Rudiger's definitely his own individual. But Barca are all of a sudden building something really attractive here, David. I mean, it's incredible the turnaround they've had as a club. Major credit to Xavi, right? Because that club is still poorly well run, I want to say. I mean, you can't just have that much of a 180 flip in less than 12 months. That club, not that long ago, everyone in the world, including Barca fans, were saying, wow, we might be the worst run club of all the well-known clubs. So I think a lot has to do with Xavi changing the culture, kind of back to what it used to be. And they have some great young talents, like Pedri is ridiculous, and Frankie de Jong is really good. And they even revived Dembele, who of course is still a really good talent and young. So they have a nice little core they're building. And I just feel like since we know these talks took place, David, when we get that photographic evidence of Rudiger in Barcelona, I feel like the pitch to Rudiger is probably a pretty good one. I don't want to completely guess, but Rudiger really thrives, at least he has in a Chelsea shirt, on being kind of the leader, not in a John Terry way, right? Not the responsible leader, but the crazy leader, like the guy who gives, especially the younger guys, a kick up the ass every once in a while when they might need it. Or young players all the time have dips in form when they have a dip in form. So I could see the pitch just being really appropriate and really perfect for Rudiger. Like, hey, we're going to let you be you and come be a top center back in the world for a top team that's going back to being a top team. Juve, of course, we know they have a decent chance. We know that. I'm just wondering what Rudiger would be more down for. And I am not inside the boardroom on either of these talks, of course, but I feel like the pitch is actually weaker for Juve. I got to. So the financials are important, David, and that, of course, could just completely smush everything I'm saying, because that's been the problem with Chelsea. I know we're not speaking about Rudiger and Chelsea now, but of course that has been the issue with Chelsea. Ideally, if the financials were there, it would just stay with Chelsea. So I kind of have to put the financials aside in my answer, even in my prediction to answer your question, because I just am not sure which club is offering better terms. And I almost have to feel like Barca might have the more attractive project for Antonio Rudiger. Like, both top teams, right? Juve and Barca, like, they're supposed to be teams that are top in their league or 1-2 in their league at least. But I actually feel like Rudiger might look at the projects and say, I actually have more faith in Barca getting back to being Barca than Juve necessarily getting back to being Juve. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you have anything to add. Otherwise, we'll just move on to the next segment. But I almost feel like Rudiger and Barca feels – I'm going strictly off momentum right now, David. But that might feel like where Rudiger would lean.
Yeah, I don't have too many thoughts other than I totally agree on Xavi. I don't follow other leagues that much, but I really thought Xavi was going to be just one of more former players like Lampard, Pirlo, though maybe now maybe people look at Pirlo maybe a little bit different. I really thought it was going to be more of that. I got to give him a ton of credit. I mean, my only reaction to Rudiger being linked to these two clubs that really not long ago were in a catastrophic financial situation where, you know, not long ago, Barca had to let Messi go because salaries and whatnot. You look at Juve's, you know, financial situation, which then got turned around with the infusion of capital from Exor. It's amazing how quickly things change, but also how much the market is changing. I mean, I think I've been saying this for a very long time that the Bosman market is going to become more and more like NBA free agency. I think Rudiger is just the perfect example of this, and really credit to him though too. I thought he was a very good player when he was at Roma. I didn't expect him to kind of reach this level, so really good for him. And look, I think Juve, I think the Italy angle helps. He knows the league. True. Most players do like it, but yeah, I think you make a great point. Right now, Barca, especially when it comes to Bosman players, you kind of feel like Barca are going to be in the mix there. And I think that also really talks about how much now the gap between the really, really super rich clubs and everyone else is growing. So definitely very interesting situation. That was an awesome opening segment, Alex. Curious to hear at the end your thoughts on Will Smith. But before we get to Napoli Outsider, who's got a really fantastic segment that I have for you guys, let's get to Thousand Names. Missed them last week. I really do want to bring him on the show. Maybe we'll do it next week after we have these key games to have him give us some prediction for season end. So you guys know the drill. I asked Thousand Names to send me three picks. I don't know which games he's going to pick, and then I'll make my picks as well. So I'm going to save the big game last. That's the first one he sent me. So let's start with Lazio Sassuolo. Which thousand names says Lazio winning 3-0 with a hat trick by Zaccagni? He says Raspadori, who now has become the new golden child of Italian football, is going to miss a penalty. And he says that Sarri has created a new top player, and he's referring to Zaccagni. And he said Zaccagni should have played against Macedonia, which I got to say, Zaccagni was really red hot right now. And he says Zanetti has already his mind on the market and that Frattesi is the worst player on the pitch. In Italian, Lazio Sassuolo 3-0, Zaccagni tripletta, Raspadori sbaglia rigore, Sarri ha creato un nuovo fuoriclasse, doveva giocare lui contro la Macedonia, Frattesi peggiore in campo. Yeah, Sassuolo can be a little bit up and down. I am going to agree with Thousand. I'll have Lazio winning. I'll have Lazio 2-1. I'll give a goal to Raspadori. I'll give Milinkovic-Savic a goal, and I'll give Immobile a goal. I wonder if we've saw the last of Immobile with the Italian national team. As much as I think he got too much crap, I really do think it's time to move on from him. Next up, other huge game this weekend is Napoli traveling to Bergamo to face Atalanta. Thousand has Napoli winning 2-0, braced by Insigne. He says Pasalic is going to get a red card. He says Lorenzo, the magnificent Lorenzo, after eliminating Italy from the World Cup, is gonna you know, get back on track with what he considers his real national team, Napoli. In this case, he says Gasperini is gonna be embarrassed by Spalletti, and Jim City is gonna have a really bad game. In Italian, Atalanta Napoli 0-2, Insigne doppietta, espulso Pasalic, Lorenzo il Magnifico, dopo aver eliminato l'Italia dal mondiale, si riscatta con la sua vera nazionale. Gasperini umiliato da Spalletti, Jim City ridicolo. I'm gonna go scoreless draw here. Atalanta just not, in Serie A at least, not been great. I really do hope they win the Europa League. They do have a decent chance at that. They've had some scoreless draws at home. They actually are better recently away. And Napoli have been pretty resilient. So I'm going to go 0-0. Napoli has a ton of players out. Next up, the big match. Juve hosting Inter. Thousand has Inter winning 3-2. Goals by Vlahovic, Locatelli, Di Marco, Brozovic, and an own goal by Szczesny. Says Lautaro's going to miss a penalty. Cuadrado's going to get a red card. He says Simone Inzaghi is going to beat Allegri despite a terrible refereeing performance. He says Dybala is going to be celebrating in the stands with Marotta, and the Zhang's poverty wins against Agnelli's dirty money. Well, that's a comment that Thousand is going to have to own on his own, but I'll read it anyway, even in Italian. Pronostico Juve Inter 2-3, Vlahovic, Locatelli, Di Marco, Brozovic, autogol, Szczesny, Lautaro sbaglia rigore, espulso Cuadrado, Limone ribalta Allegri nonostante il solito arbitraggio vergognoso, Dybala esulta con Marotta in tribuna, vince ancora la povertà di Zan contro i denari sporchi degli Agnelli. Look, I'm going down with the ship. I still think Inter has a somewhat decent chance of winning the Scudetto. So I'm going to agree with Thousand. I'm going to have Inter winning a Corto Muso match 1-0, and I am going to give a goal to Lautaro, who really needs it there. So great job, Thousand names. Before we get to Napoli outsider, we're going to do a part of the pod where we answer our patrons' questions. If you enjoy hearing us on Fridays, consider becoming a patron. Get an episode on Tuesday. Get a long monthly chat with Napoli Outsider, which I have to say I think are worth the money alone. He's that good, and he does the vast majority of the talking. So you get that. We have a tier with great articles, and you'll be joining a fantastic community of like-minded Calcio fans, and we'll answer their questions now.
Well, I'm really thrilled to welcome my dear friend, someone that I really, really enjoy recording with. We've been doing these for a while, my dear friend Napoli Outsider. So the last few times we've chatted is actually during the international break, which is a great time normally, actually, because Napoli too is still in the Scudetto race. But today we're going to talk a little bit about the Azzurri. I'm not going to the World Cup once again. I'm very curious to hear his thoughts on that. That'll probably be on the podcast on Friday, available to all. And then the rest of the podcast, I picked some hot topics in Serie A to go over. So my dear friend, it's always a real pleasure to chat. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Hi, David, and thanks for having me. And it's always a blast to be able to talk culture, even though sometimes it's not for the happiest reasons. But hey, we're there for this.
Absolutely. So listen, I like that we're doing this. About a week has passed since the Macedonia game. We've had time to digest it. There's been a lot of takes out there on why Italy was eliminated, isn't going to the World Cup. This is two times in a row. I think what's even more incredible, well, I don't know if it's more incredible, but they haven't been out of the group stage in the World Cup since W. Bush's second term in presidency. So I'm very curious to hear your take. I've heard all sorts of things in recent weeks that Serie A doesn't play enough young players. I've seen Moggi say this is all because of Calciopoli, the lack of physical education in the classrooms in Italy. We've heard all of it. So I want to ask you, why do you think Italy hasn't gone to two World Cups in a row and hasn't been out of the group stage since 2006?
You know, when these things happen, everybody tries to advance his own agenda. So, of course, Moggi is going to talk about Calciopoli. And, of course, other people are just going to use that to reaffirm and confirm their pre-built beliefs, you know. So if anybody believes anything, he's going to use this event to push for it. But the truth, simple truth, in my opinion, is that in the last 20 or so years, Italy just has not produced enough quality footballers. So this stuff is bound to happen. And, you know, just think about Italy in the 90s. They had great footballers. They were always in the tournament. They didn't win, but they always challenged and they lost, you know, usually on penalties. And they had great chances to win. In 2006, that was the last generation finishing off their own generation. And they were the last quality one because already, like, 4 years later, in 2010, there was a new generation that was just not up to par. And that has been a constant ever since. This did not prevent Italy from reaching two European championship finals and winning one of them. But obviously, it was very random in both situations. We can get into it. But in both situations, it was extremely random the way it went down in the European championships. Likewise, in the World Cup, you know, if you're just going to say, hey, why didn't we go to this World Cup? Well, there is an element of randomness to single games, obviously. What is important is that when you had great players, the gap between you and the opponents was so large that randomness might have turned a 3-0 game into a 2-1 game, right? But you would still win. Right now, Italy is probably, well, surely a better team than Macedonia, but the gap is so small that you can just have a bad game where you don't finish, where Berardi doesn't finish with an open net, and they take only one shot throughout the whole game, and it's in the 92nd minute right next to the corner, and Donnarumma is screened by a defender. That stuff can happen when there is no sizable gap between you and your opponents. But we have to recognize, I think, the main problem that is not necessarily losing the game, but it is just not having enough quality players to separate yourself from the others. Because losing a game, now Bonucci made a big fuss about it, and he said, we've only lost one game, no games in the group stage, and we've only lost one game in the playoff, and we're not going, and there are other teams that lost 4 or 5 times, and they're going to be going. Now, he's obviously right on the fact that we only lost one game, but he should also point out that we didn't win enough games. We tied so many games, and you should ask yourself, Why was that the case? And I think it all, again, it goes back to the fact that we lack quality star players. We just don't have many. We don't produce many, especially up front, which led to a lot of low-scoring games. And low-scoring games, by their nature, you know, you end up tying them. And going back to the European Championships, why am I saying that there was a lot of randomness? Italy definitely played a great brand of football, okay? There's no question about it. We don't want to demean that win. But at the time, I already pointed this out when we won the European Championships, and there's more reason to point it out right now. Italy only won one game in the 90 minutes in the elimination phase, only once. And only once, and it was the same game against Belgium, did they score more than one goal. Everything else was they scored one goal, great defense, win an extra time or on penalty kicks. That was it. And I know they played great, but still, even while playing great, they were not producing up front. And in the European Championships, they lacked a striker doing well, but they had Insigne playing some of the best football of his life, and they had Chiesa playing well. So at least they had the wingers. But now Chiesa is hurt, and Insigne, ever since the European Championship, has looked like a guy, well, he hasn't looked like the same guy. He has only scored one goal from open play all season long in the league. So once Insigne and Chiesa went missing, there was nothing behind them because Berardi's not that good. I mean, he is okay for the Italian league. He's not that good for the next level. Bernardeschi is atrocious. And Mancini suffered a lot of the what we call the winner's curse. You know, when you win, you keep relying on the same guys that led you to win. So he didn't really believe in Zaniolo. He didn't really believe in Scamacca. He didn't really believe in Raspadori. And to be honest, it might also be because those guys are not good enough themselves. But at least they offered something different. And just did not want to try them. He just did not give them a chance, a proper chance, that is. So that's how we ended up where we are. But, you know, you have to recognize, again, and this is crucial, that even when Italy was going well, it wasn't really winning games. It was tying them and winning them on penalties or in extra time. And right after the European Championships, the 10 games after the European Championships, they won only 3 games. While they tied 6 and they lost only one. Sure, they lost only once and it was against Spain, so it's nothing to be ashamed about. But if you're not going to win 7 games out of 10, you're going to tie 6. It stands to reason that you're struggling to score against literally anybody. And in fact, that's why Italy didn't win the group phase. They didn't win it because they missed a penalty in Switzerland against Switzerland. They missed a penalty at home against Switzerland. And they couldn't score enough against Northern Ireland. In fact, they couldn't score at all. Otherwise, they would have made it in the group phase. So they were just not scoring. And against Macedonia, we just saw the same. Now, the element of bad luck is what flipped what should have been probably a 1-0 win into a 1-0 loss. But the problem, the root of the problem, is that you should not be it should not be a 1-0 game. It should be a 3-0 game. And that's the main issue. But again, Italy just do not have enough quality. They do not have enough quality up front. And even when you think about the previous European Championship in which Italy ended up in the final, well, they won one game on penalties against England and they had one good game against Germany. So between the two European Championships in which they made the finals, out of 7 games, Italy only won twice in the 90 minutes, twice out of 7 games. So even there, it was just basically, you know, great defense and penalty. Defense has always been good for Italy, not just because they have quality defenders, which they still do, but also because they have a great organization at the back. In fact, even if you think about Macedonia's goal, I mean, it was a random shot from outside in the 92nd minute. And again, there was a lot of bad luck there, but there was no bad luck up front. Italy have struggled to score even against Mancini, except for those first 3 group phase games in the European Championship. He thought about, you know, playing this tiki-taka style, this possession-based style, and it was a good idea because obviously with Jorginho, with Insigne, with Verratti, he had a lot of guys that were really used to controlling possession, and they had also a lot of guys that played it under Sarri at Napoli, so it made sense. But still, even at Napoli, you know, when it came to Sarri, up front then you had Higuain, you had Callejon, you had Mertens, you had guys who could score goals, Milik as well. Italy had everything that Sarri's Napoli had in midfield and in defense. They did not have it up front except for Insigne. And again, as I said, Insigne's year has been just pitiful. So Mancini never found a solution for that. He never even attempted to find a solution because his idea was if we control the game for 90 minutes, we just need one episode, one random shot from outside. But that's basically the idea developed differently, of course, but it's the idea of Allegri, the cortomuso, right? You just do not allow goals. At some point, you're going to score one. So you win 1-0. And even if you don't win, well, you don't lose. Well, guess what? Not losing didn't do anything good for Italy in the group phase. And again, when you play cortomuso style, even though it was possession style instead of defending style, the implementation was different. But the main concept of the cortomuso of winning 1-0 was the same. Well, it can happen that you just lose 1-0 just due to bad luck. But again, going back to the root of the cause, I mean, it's we don't have enough talent. We don't have enough good players. The formation of the players, the quality of that has just plummeted. How many superstars has Italy had in the 90s? How many superstars has Italy had in the aughts? How many superstars has it had post-2006? And yeah, Moggi's going to, again, say Calciopoli. Other guys are going to say, well, the school and so on. But the truth is, we are just not producing enough talents anywhere at any level. Because if you think about it, you know, for example, Croatia has produced a boatload of talents. Serbia is doing well. Other countries that export players are doing really well. And Italy hasn't been able to even export those players. And most of the talented guys that it has produced have either, you know, flunked, like Balotelli or Cassano. And even Zaniolo is going in that direction. And to some extent, even that, though Juventus fans are not going to agree, but Chiesa doesn't really have He is a bulldog in a way. He's a fighter, but I mean, he's always diving. He's always complaining on the pitch. You know, he's always making a fuss. It seems like we are just unable to produce sound professionals out there that, you know, like we had at some point in the past. And
yeah,
that is
a big issue. Yeah, I think you said a ton of great things. And, you know, I was thinking someone tweeted me, you know, last week that you can make a case that from 1990 till like 2006, Italy had the best national team in the world. You look at no results, question. Consistency, and that makes a ton of sense to me. So yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said. So let me give you the argument a little bit to push back on what you're saying on the talent. And also the other thing that I want to ask you, because to me, things are a lot better now than they were with the Ventura situation. I think Ventura was like a really perfect scapegoat and he deserved all the criticism he got. But back then, I think there was considerably less talent than now. So let's say this, you know, the last Euro, Donnarumma was like a Marvel hero, just as good an Italian keeper as I've seen in a tournament in my lifetime, like Buffon in 2006. I think at the end of the last Euro, if you had to pick one player to take a penalty with your life on the line, Jorginho would absolutely have been in that conversation. And I think you can make a great case, Spinazzola and Chiesa were like two of the best players for Italy at the Euro. So those two don't play. Jorginho misses penalties. Donnarumma looks human. You also said about the randomness. Is there a world where it's like, okay, there were episodes, and maybe if you look at it that way, things aren't quite that bleak? What would be your pushback to that?
My pushback to that is that we had favorable episodes just the other way in the European Championships. Remember that against Austria in the first elimination game, Arnautovic actually scored a goal and he was offside by no more than 3 centimeters, like 1 inch maybe. And so there were episodes in those games too. What if you lose on penalties, which it can always happen? What if there's a bad bounce? What if, again, Arnautovic is onside by 1 inch, maybe 2 inches? All of a sudden, everything falls down. So that's the thing, you know, the only way to separate yourself from the randomness is to be so much better than the opposition, where the randomness might tighten up the game, but it's not going to change the end result. Now, again, Italy in the European Championships over these last 10 years have had a massive amount of luck. Everything that could go right went right in those two editions in which they made the finals. And in fact, they didn't win the first of those two because they lost 4-0 against Spain in the final. And that's exactly what I'm saying. The gap was so massive that even if we had all the good luck in the world, we would have not beaten Spain because Spain was so much better. But in the other situations in which the gap wasn't so massive, Italy had good luck go their way. Whereas in the World Cup, it was just the opposite. But again, it's a byproduct. You know, it's two faces of the same metal. You're looking at the same thing. Against Sweden, they score a goal on a deflected shot. That's just bad luck, sure. But then in 180 minutes, you don't score any goals. That's not bad luck. That's just being inept up front. And here's the same thing. Macedonia's goal was good, was their good luck. But not being able to score enough goals during the group phase or against Macedonia in 90 minutes, that's ineptness. I mean, that's the thing. That's my pushback. You know, if you're going to look at the bad luck that we had, which we did have, you have to look at the good luck that we had in another situation, because it's always nice and easy to say that the good things are what we deserve, are a byproduct of our ability and of our effort, whereas the bad things are a byproduct of bad luck. You have to remember that while during the course of a league, usually good and bad luck even out, during the course of an elimination game, there's a lot of randomness. During short competitions, there's a lot of randomness and luck. There's a higher incidence of luck in those situations. That's basically it. That's basically all that there's to say. And, you know, that's what happens when you have some things break your way in certain competitions. And I think the reason we won the European Championship, for example, you could just think it's karma for not winning in those 90s. You know, in the 90s, we went out on penalties in 1990, in 1994, in 1998. In all three situations, you can make a case that Italy would have won that competition if they had just gone past their opponents on penalties. And there was a lot of bad luck there. I want to even start to mention the bad luck that Italy had in 2000 in the final of the European Championship.
Yeah.
But then Italy got repaid in 2012 and 2021 of the European Championship because, I mean, bad luck and good luck will even out over very long, very large sample sizes, but they will not even out on a single game. And again, the only way you can defeat that is by having a much better team than the opponents, just like Spain had in 2012 over us, or like we had in other situations over other opponents. Again, and everybody's going to advance their issues. But look, we are lacking right now the formation of talented players. Just look around. And you can think about, for example, Verratti. Verratti never played in Serie A. This is a big thing. He never played one game, 1 minute in Serie A. He went straight from Serie B to Paris Saint-Germain, okay? So, and a lot of other teams, foreign teams, if you think about France, how many France national team guys play in France? They, not many. I'm not even sure. I think they can do a full starting 11 without a single guy playing in France. Maybe only Mbappé is going to be there, not for long. So the thing is, Italy haven't even had enough good guys they could export in all this period, which just goes to show you that we are not producing them. I know it's very easy what they're doing now. There's a campaign. Every time that Italy goes poorly, this campaign restarts, which is the troppi stranieri, too many foreigners, which is as racist and as ignorant as it can get, really. Because if you have good enough players, they're going to play. The reason they don't play is because they're not good enough. It's not fashion. You look at who has the most foreigners in their own squads. I saw this.
It's Milan, right?
Milan is first. Then Lazio is second. Okay. And well, Lazio, okay, that's an issue. That's a different thing. But then third, fourth, and fifth place are Napoli, Inter, and Atalanta. So that's essentially four of the top five teams in Italy, which means that you need to have foreigners. And I remember when Atalanta and Juventus were magnified by the fact that they had a lot of Italians, and they were saying, oh, look, they win or they do well because they have a lot of Italians. Well, guess what? They didn't. They just had the right Italians. Once those Italians were done with their careers, they had to replace them with foreigners because the Italians they had were just not good enough. So it's not like if you get Italians, all of a sudden, magically, everything is going to be better. No, look, you've got to get the best players regardless of a passport. And the reason that Italians are not playing is because they're not good enough. And that's the same reason for which you don't see a lot of young players play. Because when you get foreigners, they're usually not going to be under 21s. They're usually going to be slightly older. So if you get to play an under 21, it's usually going to be an Italian. But if Italians are not good enough, then you get both effects at the same time. You don't have enough Italians and you don't have enough youngsters. Now, I was looking today at the under 21 national team, which they played today and they won a game 1-0 against Bosnia. I looked at the 15 players they used, okay? And most of them actually play in Serie A. So there's no real argument to be made there. You have Bellanova, you have Lovato, Rovella, Portanova, Cancellieri, Ricci, and Yeboah. All these guys play in Serie A. And you can visually see them. They're not good enough to make a difference in Serie A. Actually, Parisi too. So they're all decent players for the future. None of them is good enough to start in Serie A right now. You have two really good prospects from Serie B who are Fagioli and Carnesecchi, but both of them are not good enough to start in Serie A right now over their teammates. Fagioli is not good enough to start over Locatelli, and Carnesecchi is not good enough to start over Musso. So they are in Serie B and they are playing. So if you look at these names, they're either in Serie A or they're not in Serie A, but because they're not good enough to play there yet. So who are we supposed to play? It sounds like by these pundits that if you just play Italians at a young age, all of a sudden everything is going to be fine. That's not it. They are not good enough. And when they get to the ages of 18, 19, 20, 21, I'm not saying that they're finished products because they're not. But if they're not good enough at 21, it's not like you make them play and all of a sudden at 22 you have stars. No, you have to develop better players from the start, from the ages of 8, 12, 13, 14, 15. We don't have good enough players at those ages. We don't have a large enough pool of good players at those ages. And when you do get a guy who might be a superstar at a young age and you look at him, Donnarumma, he's going to play. Zaniolo, he's going to play. Tonali, he's going to play. Verratti, he's going to play, even though abroad, but he is going to play. Chiesa played. All these guys did get their shot. So the good guys are still getting their shot in Serie A right now. It's just that we don't have as many. And the other problem that goes hand in hand with this is that when there are so few, they're always described as the chosen one, which actually plays with their head. And you see with the way they behave then, they become self-entitled, they don't work hard, they might be unprofessional, they might make wrong career decisions, they mess up everything they do. You can make an argument that every single talent that we've had post that 2006 World Cup generation has had some mental adjustment issues, some professionalism issues, some self-entitlement issues. Literally everyone. There's not a single guy for whom you can say, hey, this guy like developed professionally fine, just like, you know, the talents before him. It's just not happened because when you get so few guys, all the lights go off on them and everybody's waiting for them to do something super special. And they usually do the exact opposite because, you know, they're young players and you put a lot of pressure, but also in some cases, a lot of entitlement on them. And this is what happens. Now, this would not happen if you had many more, like 3, 4, 5 times as many talents, but that goes back to the talent production. And look, this is where I'm going to wrap up this rant. This goes hand in hand with everything about Italian sports, everything, because Italy, look, we were the best in the world in football, and we were ahead of many other countries in many other sports in the 90s. It was great. But what happened then? Everybody else advanced, and we are still stuck in the 90s for everything. Our stadiums are stuck in the 90s. Our player development is stuck in the 90s. Our scouting methods are stuck in the 90s. Our analytics methods are stuck in the 90s. Our play on the pitch is stuck in the 90s. Our communications between team communications are mostly stuck in the 90s. This is starting to change with the foreign properties coming into Italy, but yeah. Everything else is stuck 30 years ago. So player formation and player development is also stuck at 30 years ago. They are not willing to improve. And guess what? When somebody else comes from abroad and tries to improve something, there is a whole boatload of racism that goes into it. And they say, oh, what does this guy know? And they try to tear him down. All the time. We've seen that with Benitez. We've seen that with literally anybody who's come from abroad. What do they know? And as soon as something goes wrong with them, they get hammered. They get beaten up. And then there's a lot of publicity for our own homegrown coaches. Oh, my God, they do the best things they do. And just to think about it, that we still see Sarri and De Zerbi as some guys who are ahead. And guess what? They are ahead of the Italian curve. But they're so far behind the European curve that it's ridiculous. In Europe, they're already like at beyond that kind of possession style. In Italy, we're still pursuing that kind of style. Because even when we have innovation, innovation in Italy comes when it's already passed abroad, you know? And that's why we just cannot succeed, because we do not have an open mind to modernize our entire football world, which includes, again, not just the player formation, not just the player coaching, But everything, literally everything, from the infrastructures to communication to the way you treat fans, to the services you provide, to the player development at a young age. And once that is going to happen, we're going to start producing talents again. But right now, there's a dearth of talent, so we just have to deal with it. We don't have enough talent. We can compensate in certain areas like defense with good team organization, but up front, you need talent, and we just don't have it. And again, it's not going to happen because guess what? Now everybody's talking about it. But by the end of the week, when the Serie A returns, we're going to be talking about calcio mercato, about how beautiful the Juventus plans are for the future, about how great Milan's development is, about Inter, about Napoli, about the calcio mercato, the transfer market, everything is great. Oh my God, can we win the Champions League? Can we win the Europa League? And guess what? If Atalanta actually gets past Leipzig, they actually have a great chance to make it at least to the Europa League final. And all of a sudden, everybody's going to say, oh, we got to follow the Atalanta model. And they're not going to recognize that Atalanta have actually shifted their own model in the meantime, because it's all, you know, preconceived sentences that actually mean nothing. And whenever somebody, just one team, reaches a good result, like Inter makes it to the Europa League final or Juventus makes it to the Champions League final, all of a sudden, that is supposed to be indicative of the health of the entire football movement. Yeah. Which is not
like
true.
Just like winning the Euro, for sure.
Exactly, David. And they're not going to understand the randomness of a single competition. What shows the health of a movement is how many teams do well. Now, if we had four teams like in the quarterfinals of the European Champions League and Europa League, that would be different. But if we have one, even if that one team wins, good for them, it's not representative of the movement. And if Italy wins the European Championship, it's not representative of the movement. It's representative of one coach and about 13 or 14 players at most, which means nothing when you think about a movement. And that is my main issue, because once again, this is just, this week is a buffer week in which people are going to use, they're going to weaponize to advance their own agenda, like Moggi did and like many others did in other ways. Then by the end of the week, we're going to be back talking about the transfer market. We're going to have titles about wags and gossiping on the papers. And we're going to magnify the great play of our own great teams in the league. And we're going to forget about everything until next time, of course.
Minus the wags, you're previewing the second part of the podcast. Just kidding. We're not going to go too much into that. So don't think that the Lovato slander went unnoticed on these sides. A great part of a youth team product. I actually think he has been good at Cagliari. Don't think that didn't go unnoticed. I know you tried to move on faster. No, but I hear you on the talent. So let's close on this, on the Azzurri. Let's look a little bit to the future. Raspadori, as we're recording, Italy's playing against Turkey. Raspadori scored. So let's focus more on the attack, because the last time you were on, I found out that you really love Bastoni. I knew you rated him. I didn't realize you love him as much as you do. I think we can agree that at least in the midfield, there has been a decent amount of talent. I mean, not full Pirlo Gattuso level, but I would say, you know, Italy's midfield is solid. It's not the problem. But as you said, it's clearly up front. So let's talk about the options up front. You are a big Zaniolo guy. I wouldn't say this has been a particularly great Zaniolo season. And there's Scamacca, kind of the new big hope. And then, you know, we talked about Chiesa coming back. At least he does push forward and is pretty determined. Out of these, who inspires you the most? Right now, Scamacca seems to be getting a lot of the hope is towards him. So let's talk about strictly up front. Who are some of the players that give you the most hope?
It's tough because it's all, you know, It's a bunch of desperation calls. Obviously, now you have to turn the page on Insigne, on Immobile, on Belotti. You just should, because obviously they have done whatever they've done. At least I think Insigne has done well in one European Championship. Immobile hasn't even done that, and Belotti neither. So you got to move on to the next generation. Next generation, obviously, you have to rely on Chiesa. He has had his injuries. But again, I don't particularly like his attitude on the field, but still, he deserves to play, and he's one of the few guys that can invent something out of nothing right now. Even though you got to think about the fact that he's 25 and we're treating him like not you and I, but Italy is treating him like he's 21 or 22. He's actually 25. So he's actually, right now he's closer to 30 than he's to 20. So he's in his prime, and he will not play in a World Cup before the age of 29 at best. So that tells you a lot. I'm not saying that we should already look beyond Chiesa, but I mean, it's that kind of situation where we're not as young as we think we are. Obviously, and Berardi as well. I mean, he's a 1994 guy, so he's going to be 32 by the next time the World Cup rolls around. So this generation is kind of gone. You have to look at the next, and the next doesn't really offer a lot of hope. We have Scamacca. That's literally one guy, and he's got a very problematic family. I'm not going to rehash some of the stuff, but you can read about what his father has done and his family has done. Luckily, in the last year and a half, he has actually stepped away from that family, which was a bad influence. And I think that actually played a lot into his explosion, into his development. Because remember that Scamacca was always touted as a huge talent ever since he was in the Roma youth ranks. And then he went to play abroad, but he always failed everywhere. And people were saying, well, he's failing because of his mental consistency and his family, his background. Now, in the last year and a half, I don't know who, but somebody convinced him to step away from his family, and all of a sudden he's playing well. So the hope is that he's away from his bad influences. And because, I mean, his father, I'm not sure if he's in jail right now, but I think he's got a trial coming up for doing stuff at Roma's training ground. But the point is, Scamacca right now is looking like a good guy. And the great thing is, he's actually looking like a modern forward. We've had guys, you know, who could attack that, like Immobile, but we didn't have complete modern forwards. Those guys that look like Harry Kane, for example, like Romelu Lukaku, you know, those big, strong guys who are also fast and who can do a bit of everything. Scamacca is probably the only one we have in Italy right now, so we have to trust him. I don't know if it's going to work, but we have to trust him because he's literally the only one. If you're not going to trust him, who are you going to trust? And just the same reason for going after Chiesa and for giving a chance to Raspadori. But even here, we have to actually contextualize, because a lot of people talk about Raspadori as if he's, you know, he's great already. But guess what? He's 22 and he's had a lot of chances in Serie A, and he's got 17 goals, 17 career goals, which is not exactly, you know, setting the world on fire for a guy who's already been a starter for 2 years running in Serie A and has played some games for 4 years in Serie A right now, and he's 22. Guys at 22, well, they're usually quite better. Just think of, for example, Vlahovic. Vlahovic is the same age as Raspadori. Just think of Osimhen. Osimhen is the same age as Raspadori. And we are clinging on to Raspadori. No offense to him at all, because, again, he's as good as we can produce in Italy. And actually, he seems to have the best head out of all those guys. But that's who we go against, you know. Those are the guys, Vlahovic, Osimhen, Holland. Those are the guys that dominate the world. Mbappé. We are not capable of producing anything close to those guys. So Raspadori is the same age. Scamacca is actually a year older. Zaniolo is the same age as Scamacca. And Zaniolo, just to give you an idea, you know what happened to him this year off the field. He became a father. He didn't want to recognize his son, stepped away from his family. Now he's going on trial because he doesn't want to recognize the son, didn't want to have a DNA test and all that kind of stuff. And this stuff plays into him as a human being. It's got to be destructive for him. It's a distraction and it is destructive. Just like for Donnarumma, everything was going fine before he went to PSG. Then he went to PSG, lost all kind of confidence. I think he was the best goalkeeper in the world until last summer. But then he went there, he lost confidence because the Latin American guys on PSG wanted Keylor Navas to play. So they split time, and then the Italian media started hitting and bashing on him and destroyed his confidence even further. And look at him now. He can't save anything. And it's the same thing. Everybody's got his own issues because of their career choices or their life choices or whatever happens off the field. But regardless of this, if we just go to the bottom line, again, we are stacking our hopes on Raspadori, and Raspadori's got 17 career goals. And Vlahovic, I think he's got more goals this year alone, and he's the same age. So how are we supposed to face those guys and do better than those guys if we're just not producing them? And you can't even say that we are not giving chances to Raspadori. Raspadori is getting them, and Scamacca is getting them, and he has had them for a while. And then in Serie B, we have Lorenzo Lucca. Lucca, everybody talks about this guy as if he's going to be the super next thing. Well, guess what? He's 22, has never played in Serie A. He has 6 career goals in Serie B, and he hasn't scored since October. And he's worth 20 million. And he's worth $20 million legitimately, because the thing is, well, even if he's not that great, he's still probably one of the five or six best offensive prospects that we have, which tells you a lot. So even the guys that are getting chances, they're not good enough. And, you know, you have Lorenzo Colombo from Milan at Spal, and he looks good, but he's a 2002 who's not doing so well in Serie B either. So that's the whole problem. We don't have enough guys. It's not that they're not playing because they're young. They're not playing because they're not good enough. And when they do play, well, the results show that they're not good enough. And when they are good enough, like Zaniolo, like those kinds of guys, well, then all of a sudden they mess up with their heads. And we can think, and not always, of course, in the same way. Some make poor career choices. Some others do stuff that's off the pitch that's wrong. Some guys act poorly on the pitch. Some guys, well, everybody's got his own mojo. You think about Tonali. Tonali this year, he is turning the corner at age 22. But the way he had played the previous year and a half was just, you know, worrisome. And all of those guys have this. There's not a single guy, not one guy, who is following the career path or the patterns of the superstars that they have abroad. So abroad, they have more quantity, they have more quality, and they develop them better. And again, what are we going to hope on? We're going to stack our hopes on Chiesa, on Raspadori, on Scamacca, and we are just going to hope that that's going to be enough for, enough for having one great tournament. I mean, again, for example, if you think about Insigne and Chiesa, what they did was actually good enough for that one tournament that they had. So it could be enough for one tournament, but guess what? If we want to reestablish Italy as a powerhouse like it was in the 90s, then you can't just get the right coach, as they would say, or, you know, hope for the two or three good best guys. You have to roll back when you actually had so many guys that you didn't know if you should play Vieri, Montella, Inzaghi, Baggio. I mean, all of those guys. You had so many. Chiesa Senior. You had so many guys that you were embarrassed in picking. That is what makes a difference. Because otherwise, you're always, you know, hanging by a thread. And if Chiesa gets hurt and Insigne gets old all of a sudden, you can't score goals anymore. So that's where we are. And but if you're just looking for names from me, then the next generation right now is hanging probably to Luca, Scamacca, Raspadori, and guys who are already overpriced and haven't done much yet. They're just offering help. And Zaniolo and Chiesa. That's it.
Yeah. Look, I sent you that joking tweet from Statuto, which I thought it was a joke, but it was incredibly accurate, saying, oh, everyone's like, oh, we should have more Italian players in Serie A. And then you have some random guy in Serie B, and it's like 40 million for him. It's like, okay, I'll go get a foreign player for 3 million in development. So, yeah, you're spot on.
Today I read an opinion by, I think it was Alfredo Pedulla, right? Yesterday, yeah. Sorry. So Pedulla obviously is one of the market guys, best market guys, along with Di Marzio and Fabrizio Romano and many others. But the news he had was basically that Napoli are probably going to have a big, big offer in the summer for Osimhen, which is probably beyond over 80 million, maybe over 100 million from Newcastle, whatever it is. Obviously, if an offer comes like that, Napoli are going to sell Osimhen. But what is the idea that's attached to that? The idea is that obviously you need somebody to replace him. And apparently Napoli already know that Sassuolo is going to ask for so much from Scamacca that they cannot afford him. And also they don't want to sell him to Napoli, but they only want to sell him either to Juventus or Inter or Milan only, because they prefer to do business with the big clubs, which is also, this should be a side argument, so we're not going to touch it. But the point is, Napoli already know that Scamacca is going to be unaffordable. And with all due respect to Scamacca, if Scamacca is unaffordable to the team with the fourth or fifth highest budget in Italy, that is a big issue, especially because I spoke about Raspadori, but Scamacca is age 23, and he's only scored 31 goals in his entire career, which includes 10 goals in Serie B. So he's only scored 21 goals in his career in Serie A at age 23. So he hasn't even scored his age in Serie A yet. And this guy is unaffordable for Napoli. If this is not an issue, I don't know what is. And what makes it worse is that apparently Napoli are turning over and looking at Armando Broia, who is a forward that plays for Southampton on loan from Chelsea. And he might cost 25 to 30 million. Now, Broia is a 20-year-old guy who is already who has already scored 6 or 7 goals in the Premier League. So he is better, way more advanced, and way younger than Scamacca at, well, he is more advanced than Scamacca at his age, and he's way younger than Scamacca at this age right now, and he's cheaper, and he's probably better. So what is the reason for which Napoli, if they have to replace Osimhen, would have to get an Italian, when the only Italian they could get is way too expensive, there are no other options, and abroad you have cheaper and better players. There's absolutely no reason to act differently. So why are we asking, you know, to reduce the foreigners in Italy? Why are we blaming the foreigners? In fact, I'm telling you, if we reduce the foreigners, it would be even worse, because we would reduce the talent pool and we would make Italians even more expensive than they are right now. Because if Scamacca right now is worth 40 million, with fewer foreigners, it's going to be worth 60 million all of a sudden. And we're not going to improve the level. In fact, if anybody is improving right now, it's because they can play along with some of those great foreigners. Because, you know, you can have Salvatore Esposito, who, by the way, hasn't really been anything, but he can train with Lukaku, at least see some examples. Well, not anymore right now, but he's obvious. They're both away from Italy right now, but you get the idea. Last year, they were actually together. And because you can have maybe Petagna with Osimhen, because you can have Moise Keane training with Vlahovic, and they get better. But what if you have to play Petagna, Keane, and Esposito all of a sudden? Do you think the level gets better? I don't think so, personally. A lot of people think, yeah, just make them play, and all of a sudden they'll click just like that. They make it too simple. It's not like that. It doesn't work like that.
Well, that was fantastic. If you enjoyed that segment, consider becoming a patron. You will hear Napoli Outsider and I go at it once a month. We actually are just getting warmed up today. We're going to get into Serie A here. So check it out. If you don't want to be a patron and you enjoyed this pod, tell your friends, leave us a review on iTunes. I read all of them. And now you can leave us 5 stars on Spotify. Look forward to chatting next week.
Okay, it was great to hear from Napoli Outsider. As always, if you did enjoy that, consider becoming a patron. We recorded for another hour talking about Serie A. So I want to close the show on pop culture. A lot happened. So, Alex, I want to ask you your reaction on the Will Smith accident. Look, you know, I'm a huge movie buff, so I think I'm one of the rare people that actually saw it in real time, because I was watching the Oscars. For me, the Oscars is kind of like the Super Bowl. I'm really, really into it. So I watched it in the moment. I have to say my reaction at first was like, this definitely has to be staged. It became pretty obvious that it wasn't. I would say to anyone that thinks it's staged, I would ask, do you really think Will Smith would agree ahead of time to ruin the night when he finally wins his first Oscar and destroy his reputation? I have a really hard time believing that. And this is someone who's extremely cynical in general. So I'm not sure, Alex, if you were old enough to really remember Tyson Holyfield in the moment, or if it became something you heard of later on, but it really reminded me of that, because, you know, it was like a shocking moment. And to a lesser extent, it reminded me too of a time, it was the World Series, Yankees Marlins. This was after the Yankees with the Wakefield game, which I really enjoyed a ton. And they were like, we have Mike Tyson in the stands and he has a face tattoo. We're going to interview him after the break. And I was like, what? Tyson has a face tattoo? I have to see. It kind of reminded me of that. So Will Smith has kind of entered the Tyson zone, where now I'd really believe anything about it. What was your reaction to hearing this? And are you a Will Smith guy in general? I could kind of see you kind of liking his vibe. I do like Will Smith, by the way. I always liked his movies. I thought he was a good, before this, I kind of thought he was a good celebrity with the way he carries her. But what was your reaction to all this?
So I'm still torn, David. I mean, you bring up a good point, obviously, about would he want to kind of cloud him winning his first ever Oscar with a much bigger headline that has to do with him, but it's more negative. So that's a great, great point. But I'm still torn, and I'll give you the reasons as to why. But to answer the question you said at the very end there, yeah, I've always been a Will Smith guy. I mean, it's not that much of a hot take, but Fresh Prince of Bel-Air has got to be one of the greatest sitcoms that I've ever watched. I think it's often forgotten about now when we talk about sitcoms, but I thought it was just so much fun, especially, you know, in my teens and 20s, just a really fun show to watch. And knowing that actually, I mean, even though it's not like a hard-hitting show, knowing actually that he was really like the running guy behind that, you know what I mean, at a young age, being the producer, the director pretty much of that show, pretty impressive. Then so many movies, it really doesn't matter what you're into, he probably had a movie out there for you. And yeah, I mean, one of the true like entrepreneurs of the entertainment industry, if you know what I mean, because he was, of course, an actor, but also a rapper, and a different type of rapper, of course, like not a rapper that cusses a lot, but still with some skill. And then just kind of like kind of a comedian, if you know what I mean, but not really like a stand-up comedian. So a guy who wore so many hats, and you know, still does to an extent, and did really anything he did very impressively. So yeah, I've always been a Will Smith guy, also a sports guy, so I feel like there's some relatability just into his personality with myself and so many others. So David, I mean, I still look back at it, right? And there are so many things. I know that we live in 2022 where everything's overanalyzed. I get that. But since I'm swept up by it, there's a lot of posts on Twitter and other platforms that so clearly point out that something fishy was going on here. I know that someone could just say, well, you know, he started laughing, Will Smith, because, well, he's laughing and, you know, he's used to being at the Oscars and he knows that jokes will be at his expense or, you know, his wife's expense, whatever. So he started laughing originally when Chris Rock was telling the joke. And then quickly he thought, he shouldn't be joking about my wife in a serious condition. So that's why he flipped so quickly. But I don't know. I mean, it was so 180. Like, if you've seen the extended clip, it was such a 180 from laughing to immediately just walking up. And then this is where the overanalyzing comes, but I'm still swept up by it. I'll admit it. Chris Rock, there's nothing from him that makes me think he was, you know, that nervous about Will Smith about to hit him. So if it's staged, of course, Chris Rock has some assurance that Will Smith is, of course, not going to break his jaw. You know, it's going to be something that he can handle. And if you even really look at it, Chris Rock is leaning in. He's leaning in. He's almost turning his face as to show Will Smith, like, this is where you're going to slap me. There's really no surprise on Chris Rock's face afterwards. No surprise. And Will Smith even is walking back with a slight smirk. With a slight smirk. And then he gets back down and, you know, he does the whole thing of keep my wife's name out of your mouth. And he says it twice and he throws in the swear. I still feel like, you know, I've never seen it before, but I still feel like if Will Smith is really angry, that's not what he sounds like. I don't know. I could be wrong. I'm absolutely okay with being wrong. And David, your point is the best as to why it's not staged. Your point is obviously the best as to, well, is he really going to agree to this and then cloud his night? Fair. Fair. But I'll give you other reasons why he would agree with it. Chris Rock still had to apologize too. This was not one of these things where Will Smith looked like the only villain. I'm saying probably more people condemned Will Smith than Chris Rock, because at the end of the day, I think maybe the joke in most people's eyes was crossing the line, but like not the worst thing they ever heard. So I think more people said, well, if you had to pick one, Will Smith was in the wrong because he was the one who was the violent person, right? Okay, fine. But still, in Chris Rock's statement, you know, he still had to come out and kind of apologize for the joke, right? And Will Smith had to apologize for being violent. So kind of was a 50-50 in like the aftermath of apologies and everything. And Will Smith still gets to look like the guy who stood up for his family, look like the guy who stood up for his wife. You know, he definitely has to now be viewed as a guy forever, as someone who couldn't control himself, right? For everyone who thinks it definitely wasn't staged, he has to be viewed as, wow, he couldn't control himself. You know, maybe even some men looked down on him that he slapped them and not punched them. Like, I get all that stuff, right? You know, I first heard of it, David. I admittedly wasn't watching the Oscars at the time. I think I was watching sports or something, which is typical. And I saw someone on Twitter write, wow, Will Smith either, because it wasn't clear like on first shot if he punched or
in the moment it wasn't clear.
Right.
Yeah.
So someone said, wow, Will Smith must punch like a girl or Chris Rock has a steel jaw. And I was like, what are they even talking about? And then of course, like I saw it immediately. So, you know, some even could be like, well, wow, Will Smith, like what a wuss. Like he can't even, you know, knock a guy down that much. So, all right, fine. That's once again, reason against it. Like why would Will Smith agree to like slapping a guy, you know, and not punching, you know, does he want people saying that he can't even hit hard? I don't know. It's probably way down the list of things he would care about, but still fine. But at the end of the day, like he was defending his wife's honor, which could be enough. Obviously, I assume if it's staged, I'm just saying if there's going to be a payout. I know he's rich, but obviously if it's staged, there's some type of a payout. And what's the payout for Chris Rock? I'm sure you saw this, David. Oh my God, his tour sales are skying through the roof. Like this is, of course, like one of the main points as to why it could be staged and maybe is. And I'm sure you'll refute all of it and fair play. I'm totally open to being wrong on this. But like, why would Chris Rock do it? Because the joke wasn't that severe. It was severe because it was going after an illness. Like that is definitely the part that, you know, is crossing the line. It's sensitive. But how many comedians, right? Like how many times has Chris Rock probably said something going against an illness, you know? And by the way, there's footage of Will Smith like 20 years ago. Have you seen this, David? Laughing about the same illness. Literally.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But, you know, I find all that stuff, you know, we found this. I hear. Look, you made a lot of really good points. I'll say this, a couple of more thoughts. I thought Chris Rock was having a really bad night. I was watching the show. His jokes were just bad even before that. He was joking about married couples. He made fun of Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz. He didn't remember Penelope Cruz's name, which is already bad. He forgot that both of them already had won an Oscar. Then he goes to Will Smith now, and I know he knows them. I know he has a relationship. I know he's made jokes about Jada before, and though the one about Rihanna saying, you know, she wasn't nominated for the Oscars is like me not being invited to Rihanna's panties. That was a great joke. The one last night on Sunday was a bad joke. Now, I don't know 100% if he in that moment remember she has an illness and that's why. I'm going to give him a little bit of a benefit of the doubt on that. But he was bad. The one joke that was really, really bad and who I feel really bad about the whole situation was Questlove, who won the Oscar for best documentary right after. That movie was awesome. It was fantastic. And Chris Rock had the joke about the people winning being like, oh, it's Questlove and four white guys. And it wasn't Questlove and four white guys. It was a pretty diverse thing of producers. And even if it was white guys, it was just like a really bad joke. And I heard it wasn't the first time he made it. He had done it at a similar thing. So I don't think Chris Rock was having a good night. I don't think it was staged again. I think Jim Carrey had a great take on all this. I think, you know, without playing, you know, too much psychologist, you know, there's been a lot of stories on his open marriage with his wife. There's been a lot of jokes made on him putting up with her dating a younger guy. And I think he just lost it. And I think he just snapped. And look, I do have some sympathy for someone snapping over that. I think in general, a lot of people are really on edge. I'm sure he had a ton of adrenaline, you know, being nominated for his Oscar and being the favorite for it. So yeah, I'll say the thing to me that was really sad was, go
ahead. Before you get into that, the way I would definitely agree that it's not staged is, do you think it's possible that he was laughing, right? Originally, Will Smith. And then,
yeah, and then he saw his wife's reaction,
right,
and he was like, she's not laughing,
right,
so I gotta do something.
Yeah.
I think that's what happened. And then there's the footage, supposedly, of her laughing when he's slapping Will Smith. But that, I'm not gonna get into. It could be a nervous thing or whatnot. I'll just tell you, I think it was really sad, and I think more like Will Smith's speech and the whole thing that now there's this controversy saying that the Oscars did ask Will Smith to leave after that happened and he refused. And it's like, okay, I get the shock. And I think even Chris Rock, you know, maybe he was just like totally shocked by what this happened. But there is a middle ground between, you know, Will Smith being asked to leave and then giving him a huge platform an hour later to speak to a worldwide massive audience winning the Oscar. I'm not even thinking you could have not given him the Oscar that he won that night. Maybe I'd have said, you know what, after what happened, we're not going to have him speak and not get a standing ovation there. I thought it was just a bad night all around. I felt really bad for the Williams sisters, the Williams family, also him comparing himself. Oh, I would like Richard Williams. I was defending my family. Look, I thought that took away from it. So it was just the poor look. But I do have sympathy for anyone who snaps in the moment there. I do think Jim Carrey, like if anyone's really interested, I thought he had the best take on this, you know, the part on Questlove, like he highlighted that. And I thought that was really fair. So look, the one thing's for sure is that I think a lot more people are going to be tuning into the Oscars next year. So I guess you could say it was staged because of that. I think it was just a viral moment that happened there, but it's just a reminder that, you know, right now a lot of people are on edge, and I think it's a good reminder that, you know, sometimes on Twitter things get heated. You just never know what the person on the other end is going through. So I have sympathy for Will Smith on what happened, but I also have more sympathy for the winners that were overshadowed there. I want to close on Taylor Hawkins. So much happened since. He tragically passed away a week ago. We found out about it last weekend. He was the drummer in the Foo Fighters. And I really think like Taylor Hawkins in a lot of way is one of the last rock stars. What do I mean by that? To me, no band that released their debut album, Rock Band, is as big as the Foo Fighters. There are bands that came out a year before or whatnot that are still around, are really successful, but there's no rock band that came out after the Foo Fighters that could sell out a stadium in every continent. The Foo Fighters absolutely could. They could do it South America, Africa, Europe, North America, anywhere they go, they could sell out a stadium. So it's very hard to be a rock star these days. And Taylor Hawkins managed to be one as a drummer. I think other than Dave Grohl, he's by far the most recognizable guy in the Foo Fighters. It's not even remotely close. Yeah, there's also Pat Smear, who was briefly in Nirvana too. But he, other than Dave Grohl, was the rock star in that band. And he managed to do it as a drummer. You know, I was talking to my ex-wife. We went to see Foo Fighters together. And she really, really loved them. And we were talking about it. And she was like, you know, geez, you know, bringing that guy to Columbia for a show, that was really asking for trouble. And my response to her was like, in a really sad way, he died doing what he loved. What do I mean by that? This is one of the last guys that really embraced the rock and roll lifestyle. Like he went out like so many of his idols, John Bonham, Keith Moon, like great reckless drummers who lived on the edge. You know, there were always stories about Taylor and partying. And he had this rock persona. And I think he really liked that this is the way he was perceived. And we live at a time where everyone's so careful with their image. We were just talking about Will Smith. Like Will Smith is someone who was incredibly so careful with his image that he researched what the highest grossing movies were in the history of Hollywood. So they were almost all alien movies. And is like, guess what? That's what I'm doing. Taylor was like the opposite. He goes, okay, if people think I'm like this wild, crazy guy, I kind of think that's cool. Had a great career, you know, was the drummer that Dave Grohl picked to be in his band. Dave Grohl was, of course, the drummer in Nirvana, great drummer in his own rights. And, you know, he really was a rock star. And he, if you want to, you know, see a little bit more about Taylor, I would recommend Bill Simmons did this awesome podcast on Alanis Morissette for HBO. And Taylor was the drummer in her touring band. And it's really cool. Like he was really always had this huge smile, fun guy. So he'll be missed. But I really don't think we're going to have rock stars like this. You know, there are older rock stars still around that live that lifestyle that eventually are going to pass away. But I don't think there's going to be anyone after Taylor that really is a big rock star that lives that lifestyle. So in a lot of ways, I really do think he is one of the last rock stars. At least he did leave some great music behind. So all the best to Foo Fighters fans. Taylor, the band, the family, and all. Definitely a very tragic situation. So I want to thank everyone for listening to the pod. If you enjoyed it, you know, please tweet about it. Tell your friends. Please leave us a review. I read all of them on iTunes. You can leave us 5 stars on Spotify. We really do appreciate your support. We know you have a lot of options, so we appreciate you tuning in.